Head Start Basketball.
What are the best players in the world doing that's giving them success? Curry, Joe Johnson, Paul Pierce. What's giving them success, and how does that translate to the high school and youth level where we could teach that to players?
Reed Osey is an NBA skills trainer and the founder of Catalyst Training in Minnesota. He has worked with Andrew Wiggins, Jake Layman, and Paige Beckers, among many other players at all levels of the game. Catalyst has trained over 100 pro players, 600 college players, and numerous high school players and programs. The son of a longtime high school coach, Reed had a knee injury that cut his playing career short and led to him coaching at the college level. His career as an assistant coach began with 2 seasons at the University of Northwestern in St. Paul, Minnesota. Reed then moved over to Bethel University, a member of the Minnesota Intercollegiate Athletic Conference, arguably the best Division III conference in the country. After 3 seasons at Bethel, Reed became the top assistant at Waldorf College in Forest City, Iowa. His last stop as a college assistant coach was at Division II Minnesota State University Moorhead. Reed then began training in the New York City area and quickly began making a name for himself in the competitive New York City market. While on the East Coast, Reed directed the Hoop School, New Jersey's premier basketball training program. He is also the director of coaching for the NBA Big Man Clinic, based out of New York City. Reed eventually returned to Minnesota to start Catalyst Training. Hey, Hoopheads, I wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi, this is Tim Hoyer from 180 Coaching, and you're listening to Hoopheads Podcast.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Fast Draw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering Hoopheads listeners 15% off Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Just use the code HHP15 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improve communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its playbank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball. Grab a notebook as you listen to this episode with Reed Osey, NBA skills trainer and founder of Catalyst Training. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads Podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel tonight. Now we are pleased to welcome to the podcast NBA skills coach Reed Osey. Reed, welcome to the Hoopheads Pod.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys.
Absolutely excited to have you on. Looking forward to diving into all the things that you've been able to do throughout your basketball life. Let's start by going back in time to when you were a kid. Tell me a little bit about some of your first experiences with the game of basketball.
Well, I got introduced really early when my dad decided that he was going to take an assistant coaching position on the local high school team, and then a year later took over the varsity program. And so I think I was in third grade, and I quickly became his manager. And so my job was obviously filling up water bottles and sweeping the floors and things like that. So I learned the value of hard work. My great-grandfather was the custodian at the school for a long time, and so he showed me early on how to make sure you put firm pressure on that broom handle and make sure all the water bottles were filled up and make sure there was no leftover water on the floor so the players were slipping. So I learned a lot of those things early on, just being a sponge, getting to be in coach's office, in the coach's office with my dad and his staff. And I've always been somebody that really appreciated adult conversations at a younger age. And I got introduced in third grade, and that really kicked off this journey for me.
You've always had keys to the gym, man, between your great-grandfather and your dad, man. It doesn't get any better than that. It
doesn't get any better.
All right, so what do you remember about being around the team, being around your dad during that time? Do you have a memory or two from those younger elementary ages that sticks out for you?
Yeah, actually, one that sticks out is kind of a skill development deal. I remember watching in warmups, I was probably in fourth grade, and somebody dribbled behind their back, and I thought, I don't know if I can do that. And so I kind of ran around the gym in between filling up water bottles, probably like an idiot, just trying to teach myself how to dribble behind my back. It's one of the only vivid memories that I have of kind of that age, but I remember by about a half hour in, I had figured out how to go behind my back, running full speed. And if somebody were to walk in the gym, they're like, oh, there's a practice. And then there's like a fourth grader just running around dribbling behind his back. And it was the first time in my life where I felt like, hey, I just taught myself something in a short amount of time because I just set my mind to it, said I'm going to figure this out. And so I was just a sponge watching what these players were doing. I was like, hey, can I try to recreate that?
Did you have a favorite player growing up? Did you have a guy that you really connected with?
Yeah, it's actually funny. My dad's, when he took over the JV program, the point guard was an eighth grader named Eric Fallingstead. And then the next year, as a freshman, Eric became the starting point guard on that team. And so I'm the oldest of seven kids. I have four adopted siblings, and I have two brothers, but we didn't adopt them until I was in college. So I grew up, it was my dad and I in a house full of girls. And so I was always looking for that kind of big brother mentorship, and that was Eric. And so Eric then became my dad's point guard for 4 years and then was going to go to college to play and decided to come home and ended up sitting next to my dad on the bench for a couple of years. And then Eric has just kind of always been around. It's kind of been a big brother to me. I would rebound for him in the summer. And it's gotten to the point that a couple years ago, my sister was playing in a volleyball tournament in St. Louis, and Eric and I flew to St. Louis to spend the weekend with my family. And so Eric played a vital role in my upbringing, showing me what it was like to watch a player that was, you know, 5-6 years older than me work really hard to master his craft.
That's really, really cool that you had the opportunity to be able to connect with a guy like that. And obviously being in the gym and being around your dad and just having those influences. Did you know from an early age that coaching was going to be something that you wanted to do? Or was it more like you were focused on being a player because of your exposure to the game and the coaching part of it only came later? Because I know that most coaches tend to fall into one of those two camps, right? You're somebody that from the time you were second or third grade, man, my dad's a coach and I'm diagramming plays. And I just always know that whenever I'm done playing, I'm going to coach. And then you have other people who are just completely focused on playing, and it doesn't even dawn on them until sort of playing is taken away from them that, hey, I want to stay in the game and get into coaching. Did either one of those scenarios describe you better?
Well, it's interesting because I probably knew that I was going to coach, but, you know, even when I got to college, it wasn't something that was really on my mind. You know, I was 18 years old just trying to figure out life. But when I look back to it, you know, my dad jokes, there was a, you know, probably the only other vivid memory that I have is they were playing a game at a small town in West Central Minnesota, and the other team came out in a box set for a baseline out of bounds. And I stood up and said, it's a cross screen. It's a cross screen. My dad turned around and looked at me. I was like in fourth grade. And sure enough, it was a cross screen. And they're looking at me like, how did you know that? And I'm like, well, dummy, they just called this like in the first quarter. And now they called the same thing again. It's obvious, like, and people are like dumbfounded that I'm in fourth grade and I remember this. But that was just, I would go scouting with my dad. So you paid attention to stuff like that. So when I actually spoke at a coach's clinic and joked about that like everyone's like, oh, wow, this is the assistant coach. No, it's like a 9-year-old sitting behind the bench. And so, you know, when I got to college, I had the opportunity, you know, at a small level to play either college basketball or college football. And I was just a mediocre athlete and kind of a tweener size-wise. I'm about 6 feet tall on a good day, and I don't move very well. So I got to college and thought, hey, you know, I'm gonna play. I'm probably a JV guy right away. And had an opportunity to sit down with the head coach. He's like, you know, I was recruiting my best friend who was a year younger than me. Went back to my high school, and my high school coach, who's a mentor of mine to this day, said, hey, there's a kid down there that'd make a really, really good coach. And so that just kind of opened the door. So when people say, you know, I'm not really sure what I want to do, I don't even relate to that because I didn't know what I wanted to do. And it was basically set in front of me with a great opportunity to join the coaching staff at 18 years old as a student assistant, got a ton of responsibility, and that just kind of kicked things off. So it wasn't something that I was super passionate about going into college. It kind of fell into my lap, and it took a couple games for me to really go, hey, I think I can do this at a pretty high level.
Was it easier to make that transition in terms of, I guess, what I think is always challenging, or what I always find to be interesting, is just when you think about the transition in terms of the competitiveness for somebody who's been a player. And obviously, if you're going to play at the collegiate level, I don't care what level of college basketball you're playing at, there's a certain level of ability that you have. So how was the transition from, man, the game is being taken away from me because of this injury, but now this other chance is being put in front of me? How did you sort of transition your competitiveness from playing to coaching, if that makes any sense?
Yeah. So being a mediocre athlete, I didn't have the athletic ability to just run by anybody. So everything that I did had to be meticulous. You know, I would compare it to, like, you have a LeBron James or a Luka Doncic. Like, LeBron athletically can do a lot of things that Luka can't. It doesn't mean Luka's not great. I think Luka's one of my favorite players to watch because he's not super athletic for the level that he's at. And so I, you know, not to compare myself to Luka Doncic, but I had to play in a similar way, where I had to figure out the ins and outs of, like, how do I beat you that's not just off of sheer athleticism? And so when I got to the coaching game, it was the same thing. I was wired that way, where it was like, okay, how do we, I feel like I saw the game a little bit differently because I had to. I didn't have a choice. And so when I became a college coach, it was something that, because I had viewed the game that way as a player, it kind of came second nature.
What did working on your game look like for you as a player? And then we'll jump back towards coaching. Because I think that as I'm hearing you talk, I'm picturing somebody that's pretty analytical about their own game and trying to figure out, okay, what do I need to do in order to be able to have success? So what did you do? What were some of the things that you worked on? Where did you go to find things for yourself to work on? Just how did you design your own program, for a lack of a better way of saying it, to improve your game and get better? What did that look like for you as a player?
To be honest, I really didn't have a clue. But I don't know if I said this earlier, I grew up on a farm, and I watched my dad and my grandpa, both my grandfathers, just work extremely hard. And there was no excuses. It was like, I'd watch my dad, like, if you're going to go spray the crops, and the only time it's not going to be windy today is at 5 a.m., you get up and spray the crops at 5 a.m. and nobody complains. And so that was just ingrained in me. And I carried that over onto the basketball court, onto the football field. I really didn't have any idea what I was doing, but I worked really, really hard. And so I think when you work really hard, some things kind of fall into place. And so I had a couple good buddies that we were gym rats. We got in the gym. One of them was a gym rat. The other one, we kind of drugged to the gym. But we just worked really hard. And so it got to the point where I became a really good passer. And we'll joke, because I'll be in workouts now and I'm throwing behind the back passes like 40 feet on the money. People are like, how did you do this? I said, well, when I was in high school and we rebounded for somebody, it wasn't about just rebounding. I was competing. Like, I'm not going to let the ball hit the floor, and I'm not going to make a bad pass. He's going to give me a target. And if that thing's 3 inches to the left, that's not a bad pass in game. But for me, that's a bad pass. And so I was just constantly competing in whatever I was doing. We'd play one-on-one from the wing, and we'd play to like 7 points by ones and twos, and we'd be like bloodied by the time we got done. And then we go to the next spot. So there really wasn't like an analytical approach to it. It was more so like, we just got to get in here. We got to be tough, because defensively we were, you know, top two or three in the state in points per possession, or in points given up. And so we would beat you by 25 and the score would be 55-30, because we were just like, we are going to demoralize you defensively. And we really took that approach to the offensive end of the floor, which I'm sure was sometimes ugly to watch. But for us, that was just how we were wired to play. We got defensive stops, and we just wanted to act. We wanted to make you quit offensively. And so we took that into our offseason approach, where we just worked really, really hard, which is definitely the hard work piece is super important. But I do not take that approach necessarily when I'm working with my players now, but it was super beneficial for me at the time based on what I knew.
You're not trying to bloody them, huh?
No, not necessarily. We're trying to get out of workouts injury free.
Understood. Was your dad still coaching you at high school?
Okay. Yeah. So he was. So I actually, I transferred schools before my sophomore year, small town Minnesota. I grew up in a town of 490 people, played varsity as an eighth and ninth grader. We won like 5 games in 2 years. And I joke with my dad, it was the coaching, 'cause he was the head coach. He doesn't necessarily love that, but, ended up at Hillcrest Academy, which was in Fergus Falls. I went to church there. That's where all my friends were. And I found myself playing in open gyms there on Sundays. And it was like, hey, these are my friends. This is where I want to go anyway. And the faith piece of the school aligned with where I'm at. And it was just like, hey, this is the perfect fit. So I went there. And then my dad ended up coming with as an assistant coach. And it was awesome. I talked to my former head coach just last week, and he's pitching, hey, let's go to Brazil. Well, your dad's coming. Let's do a basketball trip down there. Let's do that. So, I mean, it was a really cool thing, and just to have my dad be able to come along for that.
What was the best part of having your dad coach you at the high school level?
It was interesting because my eighth and ninth grade year, we butted heads. I'm sure like a lot of 14, 15-year-old kids with their dad as a coach. I ate a lot of post-game meals in my bedroom, I think. No, I'm not sitting here talking with you about the game, but it was interesting because I was really arrogant. I didn't see it at the time. And, you know, I got to Hillcrest, and I think my freshman year, we won like 2 games the whole year. And my sophomore year, we won 3 games the first week, but I was coming off the bench and I had to fight and claw for every minute that I was going to get. I was taking charges. I was doing whatever. So it really opened my eyes to what it took to be successful. And then in turn really showed me how much of an arrogant prick I probably was the previous 2 years, not being very good, which definitely changed my viewpoint on my relationship with my dad. And he actually wasn't on the staff my sophomore year. And I thought I would like that. And I didn't. I kind of liked having him around, and he came back, you know, my junior and senior year, and it was just awesome to be able to share that with him.
Was it the most challenging part that after games, trying to avoid the conversation in certain instances, or was there something else that was more of a challenge?
Well, I didn't realize, like my eighth grade year, he wasn't going to bring up any eighth graders. And then he realized the eighth graders were the only ones who cared. And, ended up bringing up an eighth grader before me. And I was like, you're bringing that kid up? Like, that kid doesn't even work on his game. I'm way better than he is. And later I had to realize, you know, he had to let that kid come and then bring me up later, and then started that kid first and let him kind of fail. And then I got my opportunity. And I think it helped that I think I scored 8 points in the first quarter of my first start as an eighth grader. And I didn't realize, to me, it was like, see, I told you so. But in reality, he was protecting me. You have a small town with politics. Oh, coach's kid's bringing up his kid who's an eighth grader first. Like, I had no idea. And then it was super frustrating to me because I felt like he was harder on me than he was on other kids. And looking back on that now, it was like he was doing that to protect me so that no one could say, you know, hey, coach, you know, Roger's just taking it easy on Reed, things like that. So looking back on it, I was just like, man, at the time I thought he handled it completely wrong. Looking back, it was like, dude, he had my back. He was protecting me.
Have you had conversations now as an adult with your dad kind of about what his experience was like?
Yeah, I think his experience was way different than I thought. You know, he obviously had a ton of joy watching me play and have success. I think it was easier for him when he was the assistant coach because my playing time was not, you know, tied to him necessarily. So he could just coach. And he knew how hard I worked. And, you know, there's just high expectations, not necessarily that I would be, you know, a college basketball player or anything like that. It was just like, this is how the OC family goes about things. You're going to be respectful. You're going to work super hard. And the little things matter. And so, you know, we've had cool conversations about, you know, what it was like for him, you know, now that I'm a parent with twin boys, like, hey, when they get older to play, like, how am I going to handle that? Because there's probably going to be some expectation that, hey, their dad trains NBA players. He should probably coach this youth team, things like that. And then it's something that at this point in my life, I have zero interest in. I just want to be a dad.
Yep.
And so, you know, we talk through stuff like that. I mean, the twins turn two next week, so we got a long time before we get to that point. But those are things that I definitely pick his brain on to figure out, hey, is, you know, how did you handle this? What was unexpected? Things like that.
Is there anything he said that he wishes he had done differently?
That's a good question. You know, I don't know that he was necessarily anticipating my response of just shutting down as a freshman. I remember, I don't know if you remember the Chris Webber Dada shoes, the super shiny, like flashy shoes.
Absolutely. Yep.
So my eighth grade year, our best player midway through the year got a pair. Our colors were royal blue and black. He got a pair of just bright, shiny blue and black Dadas. And I was like, these are so cool. And my dad was probably puking inside. Like, we've won three games. Like, knock it. And that was back in the day where you wore all white shoes or all black shoes. Yep. And anything, if you wore gray, that was cocky. And so the next year I showed up with a pair of bright blue and silver Dadas. I still have them somewhere as like a joke to show my dad. And I wore those for like five games. And he was like, you are so full of yourself. And then I went to Dick's Sports and got a pair of all white Nikes and bought them myself and showed up. But just like him, you know, navigating that, I don't think he thought that I was going to think, you know, he watched me as a manager be a junkie and dive on the floor and all this stuff to do whatever. And then I became a player and it was like, oh no, I'm playing in front of people. I'm somebody.
That's very cool. I mean, I think the opportunity to be able to coach your kid or get coached by your dad, I think is a special one. And obviously there's some things that you kind of have to navigate on both ends, both as the kid and as the father, to be able to make sure that it works. And I think that it's something that if you can make it work, anybody that I've ever talked to on either end of that spectrum just is so thankful for the opportunity to be able to have either coached their kid or to be able to have played for their dad. And I think that that's something that not everybody gets to do. And I think for those of us that get to do it, it's a pretty special thing. All right, let's get back to the start of your coaching career. When you get that first opportunity as a student assistant coach, what do you remember that sticks out as something that maybe you didn't really know or didn't really think was such a big part of coaching? I guess what surprised you about being a coach initially?
That's a good question. I remember, you know, being surprised, not necessarily surprised, but just being, just you get immersed in the game planning and the scouting on a whole nother level. You know, I came from, you know, class A, like small school basketball where we scouted, but it was like, no, we do what we do and we do it well. And then getting to the college level, like making adjustments, how do we handle things? That was something that I was really intrigued by. And I wondered, is this something that I can be good at? And what are we, you know, you just start to watch the game a little bit differently. You're not playing quarters anymore. You're playing halves. And just you're adjusting to different amount of timeouts and players that actually understand stuff. You know, I feel like at the high school level, there was a handful of us on my team that knew what was going on, but you had to just dumb everything down in timeouts to actually get to the college level and be able to make adjustments and then actually expect the players to go and execute those adjustments. I thought, I was just like, wow, we can do so much. This is crazy.
Was there ever a thought of after you started coaching that maybe at some point you wanted to coach high school? Obviously, that was what your dad had done for many, many years. Or did you know sort of right from the start because of what you just described that you were going to stay with college coaching?
I loved the college game just because it was much faster paced. The adjustments that I felt like you were able to make, I think, it just made a bigger impact on the game. You know, I'm close with a lot of really, really good high school coaches, and you can do that stuff, you know, at the higher levels here. But the thing that really the thing that really stuck out to me was just the ability to go kind of craft your own team. Like, I can go recruit players that fit the system that I want to play. I can do this at a full-time level. I don't have to go get my teaching license and try to teach or do something else. And so it was really appeasing. Like, if I'm all in on something, I'm all in. And so the idea of getting to be all in as a college coach was something that was just exciting from the jump.
So you spent 2 years there at University of Northwestern in St. Paul, and then you get an opportunity to go over to Bethel University. Talk a little bit about how that came to pass and why you felt like that was a good opportunity to make a next move in your career.
Yeah, you know, Northwestern was a great opportunity. You know, they're in, obviously, at the Division III level, but they've made, I think they went to the Sweet 16 a couple years ago and in the national tournament. And Tim Groves does a phenomenal job, but I was his first student assistant. So it was, you know, they were really like unsure how to use me. And I think looking back on it, you know, we've kind of joked about it. Like, you had an 18-year-old kid who's a full-time college student who's willing to work like 100 hours a week for free. And I was like willing to do the grunge work, just like I was willing to do whatever I had to. And I actually sat down working Wisconsin Badger basketball camp with Howard Moore. And Howard was on the staff there, and I was asking him a bunch of questions. And I'm like, you know, what should I get my degree in? What should I get my master's degree in? And he joked, he said, you need to get a degree in picking your nose. And I said, what does that mean? He's like, Reed, you just need a degree. I said, what do I get my master's in? He goes, well, get a master's in picking your nose. I think he said, like, you know, Tubby Smith has a master's in history education. You think he uses that as a college basketball coach? And I was like, oh, good point. He goes, the most important thing for you is to work your butt off. And so whenever you need a job reference, that coach will say, Reed never told me no. And so I was like, that's it. That's my ticket. Like, growing up on a farm, the work ethic, like, I can do that. I can outwork people. And so being at Northwestern, like, I felt like I had more to give. I felt like I'm sitting here willing to volunteer all these hours and do whatever. I'm just looking for more of an opportunity. Bethel University was literally like a mile and a half down the road. I knew that their student assistant, who was their head JV coach, was graduating. I was just like, okay, I know a lot of people over there. I'm kind of connected. Let me see. And I just showed up to a team meeting. They're like, who are you? I was like, I'm Reed. And they gave me some film and said, hey, make a scouting report. And they didn't tell me, am I making it as if I'm Bethel or as if I'm Augsburg? So I said, all right, I'll make two. And I made two. And they were like, what? I'm like, dude, this is all I know, man. And they gave me an office. And I was there for 3 years and worked my butt off. It was three really difficult years, but it was three of the most impactful years of my life. I had a ton of responsibility. 1 year I was running the offense on the JV. I got to recruit. I got to do a whole bunch of stuff. It's just a great experience. I'm glad that I made the jump.
What did you love about Division III basketball? What made it unique in your mind?
Well, I got the opportunity to work D2, NAIA, and D3. And what's interesting about Division III is obviously kids are paying their own way. And kids are going to go – they're more apt to go to a place where they really feel at home. Like, this is a spot that I want to be. You know, sometimes you don't necessarily get that if you're playing for a scholarship where you're just kind of like, hey, I don't have a ton of options. I got to go where the money is. And so at the Division III level – it's more so of an even playing field, I would say. I mean, obviously, some you have public schools, you have private schools. Like the MIAC, the league that I coached in, was all private schools. In the Wisconsin League, it's all public schools. So there's obviously a big difference in tuition. And we would lose kids, you know, if they're going to pay $10,000 versus $40,000. But the types of kids that we were getting at Bethel, you generally didn't have to worry about the academic piece. It was more of a high academic spot. Same thing, you know, I wouldn't say Bethel and Northwestern are super high academic, but, you know, you had to have your ducks in a row. You had to have things figured out. And so it was a different type of experience based on the kids that we were getting. It was definitely more of a family feel, like the parents were involved, post-game meals, things like that. And I thought it was a really unique experience. And I talk to Division III coaches all the time, and that's one of the things that they love. There's a ton of alumni involvement. It's just like its own little community.
Yeah, I think the Division III experience, just like you said, from talking to a number of coaches on here that have been at that level, one of the things they do like is just the opportunity that their players have to really be involved in campus life. And then you think about the way that Division I basketball is today. And I've said this back when I played Division I basketball a long, long time ago, our season would end and coaches would hand me a 2-page ditto sheet and be like, okay, here's your workout. We'll see you in September. And now you're talking about guys are on campus for 50 weeks out of the year and you're doing all the 4-man workouts in the summer and skill development, all these things. There's obviously a lot of positive to that, but there's also, it becomes, it's all consuming. I don't think a lot of people out there really understand. You have so many high school parents and players and things, and everybody has that sort of Division I mentality of it's got to be Division I or bust. And I think a lot of times people aren't necessarily, they don't really know for sure what they're getting into before they get into it. And I think Division III definitely is a level that we've tried to really promote here on the podcast, just that people don't understand how good the basketball is. And then again, what type of experience you can have and finding the right fit at the right school, I think is so important. I'm sure that's something that you saw all the time as a coach at the college level. After your 3 years at Bethel, you get a chance to go to Waldorf in Iowa. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, Waldorf was a great experience. I was there for a year. Nigel Jenkins is still the head coach down there. They just had a huge upset win heading into their conference tournament, I believe, the other day. You know, it was a really unique spot because Forest City, Iowa is 4,500 people. You know, at the NAI level, the basketball is pretty good. And you're more apt to get kids kind of from all over the country. You know, NAI schools are generally in smaller communities. And so if you look at, like, up here, you have a Waldorf or Jamestown, Valley City, two schools in North Dakota. I think the stats are like 80% of students are involved in an extracurricular, because you're not going to have a ton of students that are like, I'm just going to go live in Forest City, Iowa for the next 4 years. There's nothing really appealing to the community. It's more of like the sports world. And so, you know, coming from a Northwestern or Bethel, you know, two private schools that are, you know, predominantly white schools, I went to Forest City and I was one of like three white guys in the entire program. And that was such a cool experience for me. Like I mentioned my family earlier, like I'm the oldest of seven. My four youngest siblings are black, but to not really be immersed in that culture and that community, oh, such a great experience for me to be down there and just not only the basketball stuff, but just learn about different things. You had a kid from Milwaukee, a couple kids from Milwaukee, you know, a couple kids from Arizona and Florida, and just get to learn more about people and get out a little bit outside of my bubble. And then to see, you know, all the levels skill wise are a little bit different. Like you have the Division III level where you generally don't have the greatest athletes. You got good athletes, but they're generally pretty skilled. They can shoot the basketball. I coach at the Division II level, and there you're going to get some kind of like Division I athletes that aren't necessarily super, you know, skilled enough to play at that level. You're going to get the high level Division III kids, you know, at Division III athletes, but maybe they just shoot the lights out. We had a kid like that who became an All-American at the D2 level, but at the NAI level, it was a mixture. Like you'd have a couple local kids that were more like Division III players. We had a couple dudes that are like, you are a Division I athlete. You can hit your head on the rim. And that's kind of like when I try to explain it to people, it's like, you know, what's the NAI level like? I mean, it was crazy. Like I was our head JV coach on top of being the varsity top assistant. And I'm drawing up like lobs for guys like catching at the top of the square in a JV game. We're playing like Bethany Lutheran, which is a D3, and they're like got a bunch of guys that can like barely touch the backboard. We're throwing lobs. Like what? I'm like, what is going on? It was such a unique experience. It was awesome. I mean, our conference was all the way down to Conway, Arkansas, and Bartlesville, Oklahoma. So that led for a lot of long road trips on the weekends and sleeping on the bus overnight. But man, super thankful for that experience.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it speaks to the fact that when you go to these different levels, that you get a unique experience in each place that you're with. And obviously each coaching staff, you take things that you learn from them, you incorporate that into what you're doing as a coach. And I think that's what makes those opportunities at the different levels so special when it comes to developing yourself as a coach, is just you get a chance to work with all different levels of players. You get a chance to work with coaches that have different philosophies and different ways of looking at things. And then obviously, as you go through those experiences, you're picking up things that you like from all those different coaches that eventually you're going to incorporate into who you become as a coach. Talk a little bit about Minnesota State. You go to the Division II level after leaving Waldorf. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, no, to just touch on your point real quickly about, you know, I got the opportunity to work for 4 head coaches in 7 years. And just kind of in my coaching journey, like, I got to pick out a lot of really cool things from all 4 of those coaches. You know, one of the things too that my dad taught me at a young age was it's not always about learning what to do. It's learning like what not to do or what you wouldn't do.
Right.
And so I got an opportunity, like I took that to heart, and I got the chance to work for 4 vastly different personalities in head coaches. I got to work for 4 different types of recruiters, and I had different responsibilities under all those coaches. And so that was super beneficial for me. And especially those first 3 stops really led to a unique experience at Minnesota State Moorhead. It was 45 minutes from where I grew up, and they had been just kind of a dumpster fire of a program for a lot of my childhood. And Chad Walthall had been the coach there for probably 5 or 6 years. He had been the associate head coach at Iowa, and they had done some things in the, you know, administration to really get to funnel money back into men's and women's basketball. And that year we won our first conference title in like 32 years. And just a really unique experience. I got a chance to, you know, have a lot of hands-on with the offense. We had a ton of set plays. I got to call set plays and just really be involved that way. I couldn't have asked for a better situation as a 24-year-old getting that opportunity to, you know, to get win a conference championship and build a team that way. It was a ton of fun.
At any point during this phase of your career, did you think that the individual training piece of it and what you're doing now, was that something that you were thinking about, or was that something that was completely not on your radar? And then just tell me a little bit about the transition. How'd you end up going towards this player development side of things?
So I probably would have told you that it was something that I hadn't thought about, but my dad actually was like, no, you did talk about that every once in a while. The reason I talked about that was I was single at the time, or I was dating my now wife, but she was in Virginia and New York City. And so it was like, oh, hey, she calls me. It's 9 o'clock. Hey, I'm going to bed. I'm like, great. I'm going to be in the office for 4 more hours. Like, I really had no accountability that way to like go home. I'm living in my buddy's grandparents' basement. And I knew deep down that, like, man, I love this so much. I think there's a chance I might be a terrible husband someday. And that was something that was stuck in my mind, because it was like, I'm very motivated. If I'm all in, I'm all in. And so at the end of that season, my family was actually moving to Columbus, Ohio, where they're at now. And my wife had a job and working in reality TV in New York City. And there's not necessarily a market for that in Fargo, Moorhead, North Dakota, Minnesota. And so I had to make a choice. Like, what am I going to do? And I took a risk. Everybody told me, like, dude, what are you doing? Once you get out, there's no way that you can get back in. Went out there. I was a finalist at a Division III school. Would have made me like the 4th youngest head coach in the country. I made the final 2 and I didn't get it. And it's actually funny, because I interviewed on campus. They didn't even call me. They sent me an email saying, you know, we appreciate, you know, your interest in the program, but we're going to hire a different men's or women's soccer coach. Like, they didn't even edit the denial.
Wow. Holy cow.
Yeah. I won't drop the AD's name or the school, but I still have that. but that was, it turned out to be like a really cool thing for me, because kind of pissed me off. Like, no, now I'm going to make it. And so I continued to apply for college coaching jobs. I was living at my in-laws, and they're probably like, who is our daughter marrying? Like,
it's the guy who sends emails.
Yeah, this dude is a bum. And so I started going to the park. I just started playing. I'd send emails to gyms and coaches, and I'd just go to the park and I'd play. And then I just kind of fell in love with playing again and the skill side. And I was like, well, maybe I can start training kids to make ends meet. And I met a guy named DJ Sackman. And I think DJ's the best in the world in the player development space. He's like, dude, I just moved back from LA. I need a guy. And so was working at a gym on Long Island right outside Manhattan and was doing some stuff on the side for DJ, which the gym had given me, you know, the approval to do. And like 2 months before I got married, that gym called me and fired me because they thought DJ was going to use me to like take their clients. DJ was like, dude, I hate Long Island. I'm not driving out there. I live in New Jersey, man. And so here I am, you know, 2 months before I'm getting married and I'm going, man, my in-laws are definitely thinking, who is this bum that our daughter is marrying? And DJ's like, well, I don't need you right now, but I'm going to need you. And so he gave me some stuff up in Poughkeepsie, which was like a 2 hour drive for me. And I would drive 2 hours up to do like 2 hours of training and drive 2 hours back. And he just found work for me that kept me afloat until we opened up a facility and things just absolutely took off. So again, it was one of those deals where I took a risk. I worked really, really hard, built, you know, some pretty strong bridges in the basketball community pretty quickly, and things took off.
When you go from coaching at the college level to doing the training, obviously there's correlation there, but there's also some different skill sets that you need to have and you need to start looking at when you're working with an individual player and trying to figure out what do they need, how am I going to help them? What was your process like early on? And obviously you learned from DJ, but what was your process like early on compared to, let's say, where you are now in your career in terms of knowing exactly what you want to teach and how you want to teach it?
Well, to be honest, I became a little bit of internally that 14, 15 year old arrogant prick where I thought, man, I've been in the gym every day since third grade. I was a college coach for 7 years. This is going to be easy. And as I started training players, this is prior to meeting DJ, I found myself, you know, I was like, I'm going to learn, so I'm going to watch film. And I found myself obsessed with Steph Curry, but not for the reasons that most people were obsessed with Steph. I watched Steph and I thought, you're a mediocre athlete and you're killing dudes. Like, how are you doing that? And then I started watching like Paul Pierce and Joe Johnson. I'm like, Paul Pierce is 49 years old. He just scored 25 points last night and he can't move. How is he doing it? And I became just obsessed with that. And I was like, man, this is so different from everything that I've ever learned. We were so focused as a coach on systems and team concepts and managing emotions and recruiting and all that stuff. The player development piece almost gets lost in that. And so I thought, man, the same way that I would dig into the details on a scouting report, watching other teams, like I need to take that same approach to player development. And so I got really, you know, kind of antsy to learn that. I started looking up as much stuff as I could on YouTube. And then actually when I was in the gym one day on a Sunday, it's kind of a unique story because one of the guys that was working called me and said, hey, dude, I had too much to drink last night. I'm super hungover. Can you cover for me? We were set to go to church. And I said to my fiance, like, can I take this? And she's like, yeah, dude, you don't have any money. You got to go to the gym, man. So I went to the gym and they didn't really need me. So I walked to the back gym. There was a camp going on another. And I'm like, who's that guy? He looks familiar. They're like, that's DJ Sackman. And so I walked over. I had a business card from Minnesota State Moorhead in my binder. I'm like, dude, I probably look like an idiot, but yeah, I work here. I know you're coming back to run a camp in a couple months. I'd love to help you promote it. And he was like, great, I just moved back. Let's stay in touch. I made a bunch of promo stuff for him for free, and he loved it, and we got connected that way.
It's very cool. I mean, it's funny how, as you well know, how interconnected the basketball world is and how small it is and just how quickly you can be connected to one person or to another. And then I think the other thing that has been a theme that's obviously run through your story to this point, and I think it's one that clearly, for any young coach out there, whether you want to be training or be a high school coach or be a college coach, the thing that I keep hearing you say over and over and over again is that it was hard work. And obviously, there's some technical knowledge and there's some skill, but ultimately, the hard work piece of it is what makes all the difference, because then you can combine it with some of the things that you did when you start talking about trying to break down and analyze and figure out, well, how are these guys doing it when they're not superior athletes? But it still comes down to you got to put the time in, you got to have hard work. And if you have that as your baseline, you're going to end up having a lot more success. And I think a lot of times, especially when coaches are young, and you mentioned this too, that I think, and I was guilty of this for sure when I was a young kid, that you get done and you're playing and you think, I know a lot about the game and I know a lot more than these coaches who are older, and I don't really necessarily even need to do X, Y, or Z. Like, I kind of can float on what I already know. And I know I was guilty of that when I was younger, and I look back and I'm like, man, I wish I would have worked a little bit harder, not so much on putting the time in, but just on the way that I approached coaching. And I think what I hear you saying over and over again is hard work. Hard work is what got me to where I am today. And I think there's a great lesson in that.
Oh, totally. And I don't know that I necessarily finished, got sidetracked in my last, when I was talking, but like taking that same approach of like, I got to learn the ins and outs. Like, so when I got introduced to DJ, I was so hungry. I was hungry to learn the game, but then I was hungry for mentorship. Just like, okay, how do I build a business that's player first, where I can provide as much value as possible? I knew that in order to have a successful business, that it was about the players and it needed to be about their development. It didn't need to be about like, how does my business model revolve around the players? And so I knew that in order for it to revolve around the players, I needed to be the best instructor that I could be. I needed to be an unbelievable communicator. I needed to be able to demonstrate everything that I was doing. I had to be able to explain it. And so when that happened, it was like the arrogance, in a sense, left, where it was like, I have to learn as much from DJ as I can. There was no like old school anything. It was like, what can you teach me that's new and that's relevant that these kids are going to grasp and just take and run with?
So what did you take away from him? What were some of the things that he passed on to you that you've taken that you think are critical to your success right now?
So we were in the gym filming one day, and it was super fascinating because at that time, you know, the type of promotion was YouTube or Instagram had just switched from pictures to 15-second videos. So we were trying to condense as much stuff into 15 seconds as possible. And we're in the gym filming one day, and DJ's like, he's an unbelievable player. He's like super skilled. He's like 36, 37 years old right now, and he's just cooking guys still. And I was not that guy. But I was able to demonstrate things, and I was in the gym. And so I get done filming him, and he's going to film me, and I'm going through some stuff, and he stops me and he's like, dude, why are you doing this? I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, no, like, why are you feeling like you have to be the player? I'm like, well, this is what everybody's doing. Like, this is the approach that people are taking. He's like, Reed, did you play at a high level? I'm like, no. He's like, so the moment that you make yourself out to be the player, you now just threw yourself in the same category as myself or Tyler Ralph or Jordan Lawley or all these great players that are now training. And then the moment someone says, hey, Reed, where did you play? And you say, I didn't. You just lose all your credibility. I was like, whoa. He said, Reed, you're a college basketball coach for 7 years. The industry is like, it's not as saturated as it is now. It's fairly new. And he's like, there's not a lot of people that have your background as a coach. Stop trying to be the player. Be the coach. That was such an eye-opening experience for me because it really showed me like, no, I just need to be me. I don't need to try to be DJ or any of these other guys. It really just changed my approach to teaching and basically what I was putting out there as my brand.
So let's go back to trying to figure out Steph, Paul Pierce, Joe Johnson. When you look at those guys, and it's funny that you bring up Steph, obviously what he's done in the game is absolutely incredible. But I remember back, so we live here in Cleveland, Jason and I. So clearly during the Warriors-Cavs finals, we became less of a fan of Steph Curry during that era than I was prior to that. But I remember seeing him play live here in Cleveland, probably in maybe 2013. And coming away from that game, and I remember I called my dad after the game, and I'm like, I think I found my new favorite player. And my dad's like, who? And I'm like, Steph Curry. And he's like, why? And I'm like, I just watched him play live, and I have never seen a guy at any level move without the ball and utilize his feet to get open, to get shots off, to beat guys off the dribble, to get to where he wants to go better than him. And I think the footwork piece of it is something that when you start talking about building a base for players, that footwork is so underrated. And I just think that, like I said, this is whatever, 10 years ago, 11 years ago, that I started looking at Steph and being like, man, just the way that guy moves and what he does with his feet sets him apart from so many other players. And to your point, good athlete, obviously a really good athlete, but not an uber athlete at the NBA level. And yet the things that he's able to do because of how efficient he is with his movement and what he does with his feet, to me, clearly that's something that if you can be able to take some of those aspects of what guys at that level can do and break that down and then be able to teach it to players, you become invaluable. So talk a little bit about how you went from, hey, I want to study these guys and figure it out, to, hey, I know what they do. Now I can figure it out and now I can teach it to players. Tell me a little bit about the process you went through to be able to do that.
Well, I've always said the best basketball players are the best problem solvers. And there's a variety of different ways you can solve problems. Like, talk like a Luka Doncic, LeBron James. Like, the difference is, like, they both put up similar stats, but they solve problems completely different ways. And so when I started thinking about, like, how do we solve problems? And then you start approaching the footwork aspect of, okay, if I have multiple options, I'm almost impossible to guard. It now becomes decision making. And Tex Winter, who coached, you know, with the Bulls and the Lakers, kind of the master behind the triangle offense, he had a statement where he said, you know, a defensive player cannot effectively guard two consecutive actions. Like, I think about, like, a baseline out of bounds screen the screener. Like, well, if I don't show on the first screen, the guy gets an open shot, but if I show, I'm going to get back picked. So I can't, by myself, I can't guard both of those actions. And I took that approach to skill development, where it's like, hey, if I can put these players in a situation or put them in a position where they have multiple options, where if they can, you know, if they can drive, if they can shoot it, or they can cross over, like playing off of the bounce, that, man, that would be really valuable for these players. And really that became the foundation. Is like, okay, if I'm being guarded and I have a little bit of space, it's like keeping space versus claiming space. Like, if I have space, I have options. So how do I get myself in an athletic stance, like splitting my feet while keeping my space? Because if I step forward and I go into that space, I can't shoot it anymore. I can't cross over. I can only drive or maybe pass. So you put players in a position where they have multiple options, and then realizing that if you do it correctly, the defense can't guard consecutive actions, meaning like if I get to my drop stance, like a split stance, ball's in my right hand with my right foot forward. If I keep my space and that defender steps back, I can either cross over or I can step in and shoot it. And if they try to defend the shot and I get outside their frame, I can drive out of this. And so I started realizing, you know, with somebody like Steph Curry, or I'll give this example, Luka Doncic right now. So a buddy of mine, Adam Harrington, has, you know, been an NBA assistant for a long time. I was at his facility like a year ago in August, and we were talking about Luka. And I said, I don't think Luka Doncic has ever been more athletic than the guy guarding him. And he laughed. And he's like, that's probably accurate. Like, think about the defenders that Luka's drawing. But Luka has the ability to shoot the basketball. So he doesn't necessarily have the ability to fly by you unless he's able to get you to crowd him or come out of your stance. And so that's how he solves problems, where it's like, hey, if you can put that defender in a situation where they know that you could shoot it, they're likely to be leaning, or as I always say, lean, lift, or lunge if they come out of their stance. Now I got options to drive. I got options to change direction, all those things. And when you break it down, you know, if you have a youth player, the compliment that you give a youth player is, well, they're advanced. It's like, okay, well, let's just work on advanced things. The game is the exact same. The problem is we just don't try to incorporate some of that footwork stuff, the foundational footwork at an early age. And if we can start doing that early, we can start developing good habits rather than getting them to the high school level and spending all this time breaking bad habits. So I really took that approach of, you know, what are the best players in the world doing that's giving them success? You know, the Curry, Joe Johnson, Paul Pierce, what's giving them success, and how does that translate to the high school and youth level where we can teach that to players?
Talk to me a little bit about the youth level. If you're talking about foundational footwork that you think a player needs to be able to continue to be able to have success and build on that as you go along, what are some of the foundational skills that you think are most important for a youth player at the elementary school age?
Well, I think there's two things. The most important, in my opinion, is your timing, your dribble step timing. So if I have the basketball in my right hand and I'm walking, jogging, or sprinting, the ball's going to bounce with my left foot, or, you know, about the same time as my left foot. So I'll dribble with my left foot, I'll step with my right foot, I'll dribble with my left. That's our dribble step timing. And the best players generally have the best timing. And so if their timing gets off, they have the ability to get their timing back. And so I've used this example. So I work with Paige Beckers from UConn. And it was the summer before her freshman year at UConn. And we went through a specific, you know, this kind of skill stacking, like four or five things. And if you were to, it was like between the legs, two dribbles, stop, go behind your back, reset your feet, drop cross, and then get to an inside hand floater. And if you were to take every single one of those skills individually, Paige has them mastered. She can do all of those things individually, but she was struggling timing them up kind of together. And it was her dribble step timing was getting off, which forced her to stutter her feet. And so once that timing was off, it like derailed the entire thing. So it wasn't a lack of skill. It was just a lack of timing. And I use that example all the time. Excuse me, because I think that that's applicable at all levels. If you can get your timing, you have the ability to unlock just about any skill that you want. But as soon as that timing gets off, you're in trouble. So it's like, hey, can we master this dribble step timing? I'll work with youth kids and we'll start them on the sideline. Say, hey, I want you to dribble with your right hand all the way to the other side, going half speed. Dribble with your left foot, step with your right, dribble with your left foot. And they're looking at me like I'm dumb, like it's easy. And 95% of the kids can't do it because they start thinking about it. I'm like, you guys are running like stiff-legged, like this is brutal. And so it's like this is one of those things that's never taught. So if we can start to develop that timing at a young level, you have the ability to get to so many other things. And then the last aspect of it is just foot control. So Micah Lancaster had a quote a long time ago. It's like, a good habit is a bad habit when it's your only habit. And I thought about that. I'm like, okay, so if I can stop, if I'm right-handed and I stop left-right, like that's a great habit. I can stop in two steps. That's super efficient. But if I'm going to the left and I can only stop left-right, now I'm going to go right, left-right. Now that takes me three steps to stop, which isn't necessarily wrong, but it's not as efficient. And that situation might require me to stop in two steps, not three. And so I started thinking about that at the youth level. Like, we want to put players in a situation where they have multiple habits, left, right, right, left, be able to jump stop, all of those things, so that they can have control of their feet, so that they have control for whatever the game requires or whatever the situation requires. So it's like with youth kids, if we can give them specifics and say, I need you to stop left, right, avoid the jump stop. Okay. If we can time things up, do all those things, I think that that is crucial to their development. And then you start to see success because you're eliminating some of the failure or a lot of the failure that's associated with just poor timing. So as soon as you get that timing mastered, now you're able to get to different footwork options, things like that. And now they're more apt to work through some things because they're seeing success quicker.
The first training camp Elite Skill Development and Performance Combine will be held on the campus of Western Reserve Academy, just outside of Cleveland, Ohio, powered by Unleash Potential and the Hoopheads podcast. The camp is designed for boys rising to grades 6 through 9 and will take place June 29th through July 1st, 2023. An emphasis on improving individual skills in the context of a team environment will be the hallmark of the training camp. Mike Klinzing from Head Start Basketball and the Hoop Heads podcast and Joe's Decision from Unleashed Potential will serve as the camp directors of this inaugural training camp. Campers can expect 3 days of hard work, intense skill instruction, and learning how to be a great teammate on and off the court at the training camp. Players will participate in 10 elite skill development sessions led by some of the best coaches from across the country. Visit headstartbasketball.com to get registered.
When you're working with an individual player, so you're talking about, again, a youth player who's maybe 9, 10, 11 years old. If you're working with somebody like that on an individual level, I think one of the things that I think trainers sometimes struggle with is how do you make that skill development in terms of footwork and timing and the things that you're talking about, how do you make that engaging for the player? Because I think that's one of the things that trainers sometimes find to be challenging is how do I take the things that I know are important for the kids to be able to do? And yet, yeah, maybe for a 17 or 18 year old kid who's a senior in high school, those things, doing them repetitively and being able to get those down and master them can work. How do you make sure that you're staying with the kid's level of attention span and what they're able to do when you're working with a younger player? Because I think, like I said, I think that's something that trainers sometimes struggle with.
Well, I try to put the decision making on the player as much as I can. And so I try to keep them engaged. I think you have two types of training. You have command training and teaching training. And command training is super important. Like, hey, dribble to that cone, go between the legs, dribble there, go behind the back. You know, you're giving them commands, and that's going to help you develop your skill. That's going to be repetition, things like that. But you can unintentionally turn a player into a robot when you do that. And I work with a ton of players that are super skilled in workouts. You see them in a game and they can't play because they just don't understand movements. They don't understand how to solve problems. And so when I'm working with a player of really any age, especially the youth, I try to talk through situations and talk through problem solving. And so like if we're getting to a finish, I'm not just going to tell you, hey, you need to be able to finish with that ball outside of your frame. I'm going to tell you why. So if you're a fourth grader and you're used to finishing with that ball right by your ear hole, let's walk through that and let's simulate where the defense would be at. And it's like, okay, if this ball is close to my body and the defender's close to my body, that ball is accessible. And that can lead to a lot of block shots. And so once you start piecing some of those things together, I think kids are more engaged because they start to see the purpose of why am I doing this? Why am I trying to avoid all these other things? It gets them thinking. And then the other part is I try not to script everything. Like at the start, we're going to script more things, but I view things as like you have your start, then you have your middle part, which could be a stop or a change of direction. And then ultimately you have your finish or your jump shot. So if we're working on a specific stop, I might let that kid say, hey, I want you to start a different way every time. Start with a rip through, start off the bounce, start in a closed stance, and then get to this stop. Or, hey, we're going to start off the catch. We're going to rip through, get to this stop. And then I want you to get to the rim and I want you to finish. And they'll say, do you want me to get to a floater or a layup? And I'll say, yes. And they're like, what? I'm like, dude, like, I want you to see the game. I want you to be creative. And so when we do things that way, I think when we do things strictly in a command training setting, players can shut their brain off in a sense. And it's just like boring and repetitive where I'm like, hey, I got to keep you engaged. And the other thing that I'll do is if I feel like I'm losing a kid or I'm losing a group, like, okay, we're on the left wing. We're doing something. All right, everybody come on in. We're going to switch. We're going to go to the right wing. Now we're going to do something completely different. And we might start completely different. And then we're going to get to the same thing. And these kids are like, oh, yeah, this is great. We're doing something completely different. It's like, no, this is the exact same thing. We just switched up the start. So now that you think it's something completely different, and now we have you re-engaged. So those are some of the things that I try to do to keep kids focused, is keep them thinking about, hey, what problem am I trying to solve here? How do I do it? And then, hey, how do I be creative out of it?
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. I think when you can build that creativity in, I think that's one of the things that we talk to coaches too, is that they sometimes worry that just because of the way that the situation is now in terms of youth basketball, that the creativity that kids used to have, maybe where they were playing more pickup basketball, that creativity is a little bit lacking sometimes. And so I think if you can incorporate that into what you're doing as a trainer, you're certainly giving those kids a skill that coaches are looking for out there. They want players who are creative. They want players who have a high IQ. And I think if you can bring that to them, you're obviously adding a ton of value. How much time are you spending watching film, whether it's of the players that you're actually working with or whether you're watching NBA guys and trying to pick up things that they're doing? How much time during a week are you spending watching film?
You know, it's interesting because I don't watch a ton of live basketball. I got twins at home. It's kind of crazy, but I also I consume content in so many different ways, whether it's, you know, social media or watching different highlights or going on Synergy and pulling specific things. It really goes back for me, you know, what's the foundation? Like, I think I compare it to building a house. Like, you can get super creative in building the house, but at the end of the day, like, there's only a certain amount of ways that you can build the foundation for that house, right? And how do you make that thing sturdy so that ultimately when the house is being built, it's going to withstand the storm and the chaos that Mother Nature brings? It's the same thing on a basketball standpoint. It's like, okay, how do I help you build your foundation, put you in spots where you have great foot control, great timing, and then also understand like who you are, but also sometimes more importantly, what you're not. Like, it'd be really silly for me to expect a 5'9 point guard to be able to solve problems the same way a 6'8 athletic wing would. And so I could have both of those players in a group, but we have to differentiate, you know, between the two that, hey, this dude might be able to jump and finish, and you might have to jump early and get a little creative with when you release the ball or things like that. So I'm constantly looking for different ways to improve on that and different ideas to give players. But when it comes down to it, it's like the foundation is the foundation, and we can continue to work on different aspects of things outside of the foundation. But really, it's going to come back to like, do you have control of your feet? And then it's also the IQ piece. Like, do you understand how to make reads? Do you understand how to flow and play within the offense and not take 47 dribbles?
Very true. Very true. Skills in isolation are not always valuable, right? You have to be able to have them in context and understand, okay, I have this skill in my bag, but how do I use it? When do I use it? And that ability to read things, I think, is something that is really important. And I'm sure that you do a lot of that when you're working in group settings where you're putting kids more in situations where they have to utilize the skills that you're teaching them.
Totally. We try to, when I'm focusing on certain skills, try to break it down. You know, I posted something on Twitter the other day about AZ FUD at UConn. You know, this is a great movement if you need more space, or if you're toeing the three-point line and you need to get behind the three-point line. And someone in the comments was like, well, how do you know without a defender? It's like, hey, ding dong, we're walking through this in a one-on-one setting, right? You break that down, you get them to understand their balance, the footwork, the timing, and then we try to put them in a situation where it's competitive, where they have to utilize the skill that we were just working on. And so, for example, like, I was looking through some footage today, like, we were focusing on like getting to a quick stop, like a left-right stop, and to create separation, and then exchanging behind our back. So we would maybe play one-on-one where the defender is on the offensive player's hip, so they're at a big-time disadvantage, but the offensive player cannot get to a shot until they get exchanged behind their back. So what that's going to do is that's going to give the defender time to react and get in front, but it also gives the offensive player the ability to make a decision like, hey, when am I going to get to my exchange? And then once I get out of that defender's in a recovery stance, how do we play? And so that would be just an example of some of the skill stuff that we do that would allow players the opportunity to kind of get a feel for it as they're playing.
Yeah, that's, I think, a really good way of approaching it. And the more you can put those skills in context and give kids an opportunity to utilize that. And again, as you said, putting constraints on it in terms of how you align the defense or what the situation is allows kids that opportunity to be able to put those skills into use and eventually hopefully be able to utilize them and understand and recognize during a game what exactly is happening. Let's shift gears and talk a little bit about your business, the business side of what you do, because obviously as a coach at the college level, you're not necessarily thinking about running a basketball business. So talk a little bit about what it was like for you kind of building a business around your basketball training. What did that look like for you? What were some of the parts of it that you enjoyed? And maybe what were some of the parts of it that you were like, eh, that part wasn't quite as much fun.
Well, I'll just start with the not fun part.
Okay.
You know, for me, that was the financial piece. You know, I was a college coach. I think I made like $50,000 in 7 years. Right? Like, so I'm not making any money and I didn't care. I was just like, I just got to work really, really hard until I get that, you know, that first like full-time college job. And so like I'm living in my buddy's grandparents' basement. Like I'm paying them like $125 a month. It's funny. I got married and they sent me like 6 checks that were uncashed. They were like, hey, you know, congrats on getting married. Here's your wedding present. And I didn't even check in my bank account. Right? Like I didn't care. I had enough. I was wearing sweats that the school gave me. I didn't care at all about the financial piece. And so then switching over to the business side, I was so focused on like providing value and getting these kids better and building my reputation that way that it was like, oh yeah, this is my job. I got to make money doing this. And so that was super interesting and uncomfortable for me. It was not, you know, money wasn't something that my family talked about. We were farmers, right? You just like work really hard. And it's like some years it's good, some years it's not. And so that was the interesting piece for me. But I loved the relationship piece that I got to get with the players. You know, that was one of the things that I knew I was going to miss being a college coach is, you know, the bus rides or guys ducking their head into the office and talking them hoops or talking life, that mentorship piece. So it's, I really liked the fact that I got to be in front of more kids. It wasn't like the same 12 to 15 guys for, you know, for the entire year. So I really liked that. And then the other part was I'm very self-motivated. Like a lot of the stuff that I've done, you know, whether it's web design or social media or video editing, like I'm all self-taught. And so I really loved that piece of not having anybody look over my shoulder telling me what to do. Because I loved it. I was, like I said, if I'm in, I'm in. And so I just had that mindset of like, I can grind it out instead of being a really bad husband and being in the office, I can go kiss my wife goodnight and then walk downstairs to my office and do that.
Yeah. I think the opportunity to be able to do those things as a self-taught person, there's a lot of satisfaction in that. I know with the podcast, Jason and I can attest to this, that when we started, we had no idea what we were doing and we weren't doing interviews at first. It was just him and I sitting at his mom and dad's kitchen table and recording. And then we're like, okay, maybe we got to figure this thing out. We had a couple of interviews that we did on site. And then all of a sudden we're like, well, we better figure out how to do remote interviews. And we better figure out how to get this thing sound a little bit better. And as you learn and you go through the process, then you sort of get that satisfaction of, hey, I figured this out and I'm the person that is doing it. And then I think the next challenge, which I'm sure is one you've run into, is as you become sort of that one-man shop, there's a limit to how much you can grow until you start to be able to delegate and grow. And I know you have a number of people that are working for you. So talk a little bit about going from being, hey, I'm a one-man shop, to now suddenly I'm working and I'm having some other people work underneath me and doing some things for me and picking that up. Because I think as a business owner, that's sometimes a challenging leap to take is you tend to be a control freak and want to know and do things. And especially when you're self-taught, you're like, hey, I can do this, but you kind of got to let some other people take over some aspect of it if you want to grow. So talk a little bit about maybe that stage in your business.
Yeah, it was interesting because I'm not good at delegating. I've gotten quite a bit better at it, but you know, I'd have business mentors that are like, hey, like your website, like, you know, give that over to somebody else. I'm like, dude, this is my baby. Like I've built this thing. I'm self-taught. Like I'm not letting anybody touch this thing. Like that's my baby. And realizing like, okay, I need to be able to give some of this stuff up. And then the other part was, yeah, Catalyst Training was growing, but it was Reed Osi. And so I knew that I was, you know, basically capped out. I had people calling that wanted me to come run camps and things like that. And I felt like I couldn't leave the Twin Cities because I had clients here And I felt like I owed them my time. I needed to be here. And so I was really hesitant, like, how am I going to grow? I know I need to grow. But I also, like, when we were running the hoop school in New Jersey, we launched a membership program. And we got like 70 kids in it right away, and it was really good. But we realized that how we priced it is it was kind of cheaper than after school programs for some of those kids. And so we had really good players, and then we had really bad players. And it got to the point where the really good players were like, hey, we love these workouts, but we got some ding dongs running around over here that don't want to be here, and they don't even play basketball.
Right.
And so I was like, man, how do we grow this the right way? And so I had a couple guys that worked out with me that I had trained for a couple years that were interested. And so it was really important to me from a terminology standpoint, just from a flow, that they used the same terminology. They taught the same, you know, I wanted them to make it their own. But if a kid was going to work out with me and then they were going to work out with one of my other guys, I wanted that to be somewhat of a seamless transition. And so I was sort of bringing those guys around more, having them so the kids got comfortable, and then I'd have them teach while I was there. And then it gave me the opportunity to really, you know, step out of my comfort zone and do the same thing that DJ did for me, which was, you know, mentor them and say, hey, you know, that was great what you said there, but it took a minute and a half and you got to get it done in 45 seconds. Otherwise, you're going to lose these kids.
Right.
And so it got to the point where, you know, we work with programs in the fall, high school programs. I think we had 29 this last fall, and we have 5 programs on a Wednesday. Well, I can't be in 5 different gyms. So I got to the point where I was like, hey, we have other guys coming, and I've built a reputation that if Reed sends somebody, they're good. And so I never wanted it to be a situation where they're like, hey, who's this knucklehead that you sent to the gym to work with our kids? And we haven't had any complaints. And so that's one of the things that I learned. Maybe I grew too slow, but I was super hesitant after that experience in New Jersey. Like, I was leaving money on the table in the short term because I knew long term the most important thing was building up a reputation, and that reputation was going to be sustained by guys that knew what they were doing. And so I was really patient, and I'm glad that I did it that way.
What's your process for working with a trainer that you bring in to make sure, as you said, that you're on the same page in terms of the way you're teaching, what you're teaching, the terminology? How do you go about making sure that that takes place?
Well, one of the things that I've gotten to the point where I have a couple other guys, the guy named Ryan Brueggemann plays in England right now, and then another guy named Ryan Miller, that are with me all the time. And so it's gotten to the point where they've seen me mentor them. They're super talented and they can run. I mean, they basically, when I'm gone running camps all summer, they're running our small group membership program. They work with a ton of teams. And so I can send guys to work with them when I'm not around and say, hey, you know, we got to be able to build up this entire team, because if the more guys we get, the more work we're able to take on, the more opportunities for those guys. And so I try to get them to spend time with me first with the teams, because the team versus the small group stuff is going to be different. Right. Small group stuff, if you have, you know, 6 to 8 kids in a gym, you can get more in depth with the skill stuff. With the teams, you know, might have 40 kids in the gym. It's not necessarily as specific. So getting coaches in that situation, seeing how we handle big groups, but then getting a grasp for some of the footwork stuff, they start to build their foundation of knowledge. And then ultimately getting them into small groups, seeing how we do things, and then having them teach some stuff that they're comfortable with. I try to, you know, pick a couple things. Hey, what are you most comfortable teaching? And if they go teach that, then they start to get some confidence in their ability to teach. We can kind of critique that a little bit and then slowly give them some stuff. But if they're around me quite a bit, they start to see kind of how things progress, how we do things. And I think they pick up pretty quickly. And we see that with the players too, where if I give the players a little bit of freedom, I'll say, you got to stop. You're screwing up my workout because you're getting out to all the progressions before I'm introducing them. And we're running out of stuff to work on today.
Tell me a little bit about how you mind shift in terms of when you're working with a really high level player, you're working with somebody in the NBA, you're working with somebody like Paige, you're working with a fourth grader. How do you shift your mindset in terms of just the skill level of those players obviously you're giving everything that you have to both sets of people, whether you're working with a fourth grade player who's there for the first time, or whether you're working with a player who plays at a really high level. But just how do you go and shift from one to the other? I think it's a really tremendous skill to be able to work with players at different levels. So talk a little bit about how you approach that.
Yeah, I try to take the same approach, to be honest. You know, it's interesting. You talk about professional basketball players. We kind of put them on a pedestal as being, you know, completely different. A lot of them are just normal human beings. And so, like, it's fascinating. Like, I'll walk into a gym with a fifth grader and their mom is like, hey, you know, how are the twins? How's your wife? We have those types of conversations. Or Andrew Wiggins walks in the gym and the first thing he asks are, how are the boys?
Yeah.
Right? Like, yep. It's so the approach, like, in terms, like, I'll say this. I try to connect with the player, you know, try to understand, like, how are you wired? What's your personality? And, you know, what, like, do you need someone to get on you? Do you need someone to kind of pat you on the back and encourage you that way? Like what makes you tick? And then really just approach it from that standpoint. You know, I have fourth graders that need to be coached harder than professional players. And then I have professional players that want to be coached really, really hard. I have professional players that want me to introduce something and then they want to kind of figure it out on their own. And so, I don't know. I think it sounds silly. Like, people are like, well, you work with NBA players, so how could you work with a youth player? And it's like, no, I think a lot of it's the same. You got to connect with the player. You got to figure out how they're wired and then try to introduce things that you think will help their game and challenge them.
That connection piece, I think, is huge. I think that's really where it all starts is, do you connect with the player where that player, again, regardless of the level, believes that you can help them and make them better? And that's A, developing the relationship, and then B, developing the trust between yourself as the trainer and them as the player. And I think that goes for whether you're working with a player at the highest levels of the game in the NBA, or you're working with somebody who's in fourth grade, where maybe you got to also build trust with the mom and dad in that case. But clearly, building that trust and building that relationship to me is critical.
Oh, 100%. And I think, you know, I sometimes have more difficulty with the younger players. Like, it's fascinating. Sometimes you have mom or dad come in and they feel like they got everything figured out, or they feel like they got to come in and kind of explain what I need to do.
Right.
Or they know what they're coming to me because their kid won't listen to them, but it's not that they're good enough. You're not good enough to teach their kid. It's just they want a different voice. And I walk in the gym and I might ask Paige, like, what, you got anything specific? And she's like, it's your show, man. Or, you know, and like that continues to wow me. You know, like Wiggins is the same way. Jake Layman played for the Timberwolves. Like, a lot of those players, they come in and they're just like, I just want to work. I want to see if you can give me something that's going to make me think. You know, it's interesting. You have Paige Beckers and AZ Fudd. They're best friends. They play at UConn. They're both number one recruit in their class. And there are times where Paige seems like, I'll be like, hey, are you good? But that's just how she's wired. Like, she just demands excellence out of herself. She get a little grumpy. AZ will make a mistake and she'll go, oh, that could have been better. and I'll joke with her and she's like, oh yeah, it's funny. Paige will like get mad and like want to throw a basketball, and AZ just like says like, ah, shucks. But they have like the same exact expectations of themselves. So it's just like trying to figure out like, hey, you guys are the same in your approach, but your demeanor outwardly is completely different. So it's like, how do you coach that? And that's the part that I love. I love being able to take a really good player and challenge them. Sometimes you make them feel like you're teaching them how to walk again with some of the footwork. But ultimately, it's like, hey, how can I connect with them and build up some trust and go about it that way?
How do you prep for a particular workout? So you're going to work with a player. Let's just say you're going to work with Paige. What's the prep work like for that one individual workout? What exactly are you going through? What processes do you go through to get that ready to go?
Well, I try to watch some film and not only look at, you know, you have skill stuff, but then you also have situational things. So it's like, okay, what are some situations that she's going to find herself in? You know, what type of angles is she coming off ball screens? What type of actions do they utilize to, you know, to get her in space or get her in an advantage? And then go, okay, this is where I see her. What are some skill things that we can, you know, maybe attack that might be make her a little bit more effective? And so that's really my approach, is we'll kind of go all over the place where it's like, okay, you find yourself in some ball screen stuff. That means we got to talk through that specific ball screen situation. But you might also find yourself in a switch off of that where you're in an isolation situation. So we can incorporate some different movements that way. So it depends on how often I'm going to get them. You know, hey, are you here for a week? Are you here? Is this a one-off thing? Like what is it? We try to take that approach. If I know I'm going to get them 3-4 times while they're back, then we'll try to progress. Otherwise, if it's like a one-off deal, like, hey, I'm in town for 24 hours, then we take a completely different approach and try to see, like, hey, are you looking to get shots, cardio, or do you want this to be like educational and me give you as much stuff as I can?
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. I think being able to cater to what that player wants, and again, the situation of how often you're going to be able to work with them. And clearly it's different for each individual in terms of how you prepare and what you go about doing. We're coming up close to an hour and a half, Reed. I want to wrap it up by asking you one final two-part question. Part one being, when you look ahead over the next year or two, what do you see as being your biggest challenge? And then the second part of the question is, what's your biggest joy when you think about what you get to do each and every day? So your biggest challenge and then your biggest joy.
From a challenging standpoint, it's that's a good question. The business is really exploding. You know, I have a ton of requests for camps. Being from small town Minnesota, and having a unique last name, I think people have always recognized that the last name just from my dad and myself as a player, and that the name has just continued to grow as people recognize that and they see kind of the online presence. And I have a lot of really good coaches that have helped, you know, grow the business by saying, hey, we bring Reed in. We've had a ton of success. Our kids love him. And so I'm at the point where it's like, okay, there's only one of me to do the traveling. And then the other part is like, I got Jackson and Jameson, my twins that turned 2 in a week at home. My wife, like, I love being on the floor, but it's like, hey, I realize that, you know, they're only young for about 4 years.
Yep.
And then like, I don't want to miss that. You know, we've had a blizzard the last 2 days and we've been inside, and it's like, man, I can't wait for the summer to be able to go to the splash pad with them and spend some time in the lake and just doing things like that outside. And so that's going to be, I think, my biggest challenge. It's like, hey, I'm a basketball trainer, but that's not my identity. I'm a husband and I'm a dad and I love that. And so it's kind of navigating that. It's going to be interesting. And then ultimately the biggest joy that I get out of this is someone asked me that question, like, you know, what are you most proud of? I said, it's a community that we've built. We've just having good people around, you know, it's been really interesting. We get a lot of people. I don't know how to say it. We had a lot of people that just want to be a part of this, that when we get kids in the gym that are kind of knuckleheads, they kind of phase themselves out. Like, they don't fit. And that's been super interesting to watch that kind of develop over the last 4 or 5 years, because, you know, it was one of my concerns. Like, we talked about the New Jersey situation. Like, what happens if we get knuckleheads in here? And we got such a great community of kids and parents that just, like, they want to be. I'm getting pictures sent to me by moms of like Maxwell Woods and Grayson Ullman, two competing schools, they work out all summer. And it's like a picture of them guarding each other. And it's like, they're taking pictures after the game. It's like, they didn't know each other before they came to the gym with me. And it's like being able to build that community and, you know, have parents show up when we had the twins and they're in the NICU, and we show up and there's just like gifts at the front door for the boys. Like, that sense of community. I mean, I know that I'm going to be invited to weddings and things like that in the coming years. I'm really proud of what I've built, what my wife has kind of help build, and then just the team of people that I have around me.
It's awesome. Really good stuff. And I think that all the detail that you've gone into tonight, and just you can tell the passion that you have for what you do. And that's really what it's all about. When you bring that hard work, which has been a theme that you've talked about throughout the night, I think all that combination of the hard work that you put in and the attention to detail, that's obviously what has made you successful. Before we get out, I want to give you a chance to share how people can connect with you, find out more about what you're doing. You can share social media, website, email, whatever you feel comfortable with. And then after you do that, I'll jump back in and wrap things up.
Yeah. So my website is basketballcatalyst.com. You know, we just launched a coaches education platform on there. That's super cool. We have over 300 videos. Just got a lot of really unique stuff up there, from, you know, drill work to individual skills. We have, you know, off-season workout programs for people. It's just kind of an all-inclusive deal. We wanted to put that all together, so we're really excited about that. That's on basketballcatalyst.com. And then on social media, my Twitter is ReedOuse. It's ReidOuse. And then on Instagram, I'm Coach Ouse. We got my community phone number is on there, in the bio. That's me that responds. So it's not somebody else. So if you have questions, like, it's a great opportunity to connect with me and kind of join that community, where we send out free content every once in a while. Just allows me to stay connected to coaches and kind of build relationships that way.
Awesome. Can't thank you enough, Reed, for jumping on tonight and joining us. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening. And we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Your first impression is everything when applying for a new coaching job. A professional coaching portfolio is the tool that highlights your coaching achievements and philosophies, and most of all, helps separate you and your abilities from the other applicants. The Coaching Portfolio Guide is an instructional membership-based website that helps you develop a personalized portfolio. Each section of the portfolio guide provides detailed instructions on how to organize your portfolio in a professional manner. The guide also provides sample documents for each section of your portfolio that you can copy, modify, and add to your personal portfolio. As a Hoopheads Pod listener, you can get your Coaching Portfolio Guide for just $25. Visit coachingportfolioguide.com/hoopheads to learn more.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads Podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.